Welcome to New Books in World Affairs. I'm your host, Anna Levy. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Vanessa Ogle about her book, The Global Transformation of Time, 1870 to 1950, published by Harvard University Press in 2015. Dr. Ogle is the Julian Martin Franklin Assistant Professor in History at the University of Pennsylvania, where she teaches modern European history. Set mainly in three regions, including the modern Middle East, South Asia, and Europe, The Global Transformation of Time traces the political, social, and economic origins of modern timekeeping. Hi, Vanessa. Thanks so much for joining us today on New Books in World Affairs. It's really nice to be able to speak to you today.
Hi, Anna.
I'm going to jump right in. I really appreciated reading this book for a lot of reasons and read it over the course of the last few months. And, you know, as we talked a little bit about before, I kind of came back to the notes for the book right as Brexit was happening. And I had this suddenly very different way of understanding what was going on in terms of various sort of historical infrastructures that are maybe being undone on top of, you know, some of the other more visible elements of that whole debate. So where I want to start is, you know, in reading the book, I'm not sure what I was expecting, but very quickly I realized that it's a book about the globalization of time, and globalization being something pretty specific over the course of a century. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what brought you to write a book on the globalization of time in the context of 19th century globalization leading up to the 20th century?
Yeah, sure. So that's an important observation to say that it is actually sort of a book that in a way uses time as a lens through which to look at something like globalization. So almost in the first instance, it is, as you say, a book more about an interconnected world and the way in which that world works, the way in which certain dynamics of globalization and so on works, as exemplified in the example of time, if you want. So that's important to say, to start off with, because of course there are many books that, if you want, are interested in time much more than they're interested in globalization in the very same period, written by historians of science who have taken sort of a very different approach to this. So what got me interested in the topic was, I guess you could say, sort of my academic trajectory, starting as an undergraduate in Germany, in my native Germany, where I was born and raised, and did my undergraduate studies primarily in, if you want, modern European history. And modern European history, or generally sort of modern, what in German academia is still often just referred to as, if you want, just modern history, is often in many departments pretty much sort of the history of Germany, of France, to a certain degree, of Britain. So if you want, Western Europe. And it is still sort of less common for instance, Chinese history, South Asian history, Middle East history, to be actually taught in history departments and to be part of a regular history curriculum. These, if you want, regional specializations outside of European history are often relegated to separate departments, to area studies. So they don't really form part of history education. And this is why I, as an undergraduate, was exposed primarily to European history, even though nominally I was just doing, if you want, modern history without having a kind of regional focus. And at the same time, this was a period when German academia and German academia history, sort of the profession, became more interested in, for instance, the colonial pasts of different sort of national European histories. And I ended up doing my undergraduate thesis on French colonial exhibitions. And at the same time, I realized that I was increasingly interested in French and British imperial ventures in the Middle East in the late 19th and early 20th century. And in the way in which sort of informal imperial interest played out, especially in the Levant and today Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, Israel, Jordan, and so on. But I also realized that I would want to approach a sort of topic like that, having more of a kind of area studies background, and especially knowing languages of the region. So in a pretty kind of unfocused way, while I was approaching the end of my undergraduate studies, I started studying Arabic. So that was already sort of there as a kind of less defined, less directed, if you want, interest. And then when it came to sort of deciding where to go with a PhD thesis project, initially I was going to do that in Germany. Again, I was reading sort of books that increasingly talked about the second half of the 19th century as an age of empire, as an age of internationalism, as an age of, if you want, globalization, and as generally a time period in which certain facets of globalization that we still see at work today were prefigured or came into existence in certain ways. And I was very interested in that. And as one aspect of this whole sort of interconnected history of the second half of the 19th century, it was always mentioned that time was one of the dimensions, one of the aspects of this international life and interconnectedness that became standardized and universalized in this period through the introduction of Greenwich time, which was said to have happened sort of surrounding a conference in 1884 and then subsequently sort of being applied in different places. And I found that intriguing, and I realized that while there were accounts of this process that looked at the adoption of mean times from the perspective of history of science, there weren't really books that dealt with this in a sort of much more really global perspective that took into account the imperial, colonial dimensions of this process, and that also was sort of more seriously interested in what societies outside of Western Europe and the United States thought about time, both the time that they were now supposed to apply, so the new, if you want, standardized Greenwich Mean Time, but also what they thought about other, if you want, varieties of time, what they actually kind of came up with themselves under the impression of an increasingly interconnected and globalizing world. And so I put this project together sort of out of an interest in international history and colonialism, empire, the second half of the 19th century as an increasingly globalized world, and if you want, a particular interest in the Middle East. And I brought these two things together. And eventually then I sort of moved to the United States to continue my PhD there, or to actually to start the PhD. And at that moment, I was nominally in a program that called itself International Global History, so quite different from sort of the German academic, the way in which disciplines and regional specializations were so organized in Germany at this point. And that was a very conscious choice of sort of moving to a different academic environment where it would be possible to do such a project.
And it seems throughout the book, I mean, you cover such an enormous range of forces that influenced time reform, calendar reform, some passive, some active. And I want to ask you a little bit about the active agents of change over the course of a century and a half, in from standardizing mean times to summertime to all of these different notions of uniform or disaggregated time. It seems like there are four kind of main forces or phenomena that you organize the book around, and that's nationalism, colonialism, capitalism, and religion. So I'm wondering if you can just talk a little bit about these different forces or phenomena, how they worked together in opposition to one another over the course of the period that you talk about.
Yeah, so what you just mentioned, nationalism, colonialism, religion, and capitalism, needs to be, if you want, put in contrast with sort of a different set of actors, which is often thought to have been really kind of an impulse for the standardization of time. And that group of actors you could characterize as a sort of internationalist movement of scientists and diplomats who convened at conferences, who were mainly, of course, from Western Europe, with the occasional exception, and from the United States. And they met at conferences where they sat together as scientists, as diplomats, as sort of lower-ranking politicians, and talked about a system for basically easily calculating and comparing mean times that would be rational, neutral, scientific, and that would be based at the observatory of Greenwich in the United Kingdom, and would consist of 24 time zones, each an hour wide. And that system would sort of be basically imposed or introduced and serve, if you want, as a kind of lubricant in this world that was getting ever more interconnected, in which things, people, goods, and so on moved across borders, moved between continents, regions, and so on. So this is sort of the narrative that these proponents gave of what they were trying to achieve with this system. But what I try to show in the book is, as you rightly point out, is how it was sort of a different set of dynamics that then actually really is what shapes how the process plays out. Nationalism and national interests in applying and using these new times was very much of the forefront. So after these conferences convened and after the scientists had basically finished discussing what they were proposing, national governments had to decide what to do with such proposals and had to basically craft legislation that would introduce new nationwide, countrywide mean times, and that would replace the local times, sometimes regional times that were in use up to then, taken from the position of the sun in a given location. And so when the French or the Germans and even the British contemplated what to do with such, you know, calls for a universal system of timekeeping, national interests and often geopolitical considerations stood front and center. So the Germans, for instance, introduced what was officially the universal, neutral, rational system of Greenwich Mean Time, not as GMT or as universal time or something, but rather they called it Central European Time, or in German, Mitteleuropäische Zeit, which was a concept. Central Europe, Mitteleuropa, was a concept that really kind of came out of geopolitics at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, where it denoted Germany's very specific kind of middling position on the European continent as falling between Russia in the east and, if you want, sort of Western Europe and France in the west, and comprising a lot of space in between, sometimes sort of joint with Austria-Hungary in that case. And that, of course, had profound political implications for the system of alliances, of geopolitical alliances, as it was forming really from the 1890s in Europe, where Germany allied itself precisely with Austria-Hungary, eventually against Russia, France, and Britain, and so on. So this was not a neutral way of thinking about what such a new mean time could mean for a country like Germany. And similarly, but sort of coming, if you want, from different considerations, the French, for a very long time, as is well known, rejected the adoption of the new system of mean times and of Greenwich time, because to them it meant, if you want, British time that was named after the main observatory of the British Empire. And so as a kind of expression of anti-British and also, if you want, probably imperial competition, as long as possible, France stayed outside of this new system. It was only in 1911, which sort of for continental Europe was rather late, that nominally the French joined the system and adopted Greenwich Mean Time. But even then, they refrained from actually calling it Greenwich Time, or again, sort of Universal Time, something like that. They called it Paris Time minus, and then they basically applied the time difference between Paris and London. So they said Paris Time minus 9 minutes, and so on, so on, so on. So again, there you have a very specific kind of nationally inspired way of thinking about the meaning the meaning of this new time and this new resource. And we see this play out in the colonial world as well, where once administrators beginning in the 20th century set out to adopt mean times for different colonies in sub-Saharan Africa, in Asia, and so on, where they very much thought in sort of regional terms, and where they adopted mean times that were completely, if you want, out of sync with the supposedly universal system. So often colonies would get mean times that differed from Greenwich, not by even hours as it had been stipulated, but for instance, by half hours, by quarter hours, by 20-minute differences, and so on. Or a colony would adopt a mean time that was sort of nominally outside of the time zone in which it actually fell. But for various reasons, the administrators of said colony found this particular time to be more convenient because it was the time that was applied in the neighboring colony, and because said colony had a lot of commercial, otherwise political contact and exchange with that other territory, it seemed much more convenient to simply adopt a time that would make sense in this regard than to adhere to the stipulations that had been put forward at these international conferences, and that was supposedly neutral, rational, and so on. So nationalism was very important in shaping the decisions of governments, both in Europe, but also beyond that in the colonial world. One of the other dimensions and dynamics that you mentioned, which shaped this process, which I can perhaps sort of speak to in a little more detail, is capitalism, or rather sort of the way in which perhaps capitalism did not so much shape this process. So there's a long-standing assumption in the historiography on the standardization of time, but also generally sort of the way in which people thought about time, internalized notions of time that we associate with E.P. Thompson and with a famous article that he wrote about time discipline, what he calls time discipline, and industrial capitalism. And there he states basically that in the late 18th and early 19th century, so quite a bit before the time that I'm looking at, late 18th, early 19th century, it was through the experience of factory work and the discipline and regularity that came with factory work, with increasing factory work, that a growing number of people sort of internalized the discipline and sort of regularity of certain time regimes that we associate with a certain kind of capitalist modernity. But what I found, so you, based on that, you could kind of expect that, you know, there were, for instance, factory owners, there were business interests, people like that, interests like that, lining up behind these proposals to introduce mean times, because that, you know, might have been in their interest as well. But what I, and that's what I basically started out looking for. But I did not find this, and it surprised me. And what I instead found was sort of a world in which really kind of the application of these new times remained rather patchy and sketchy for much longer than we thought. And so the assumption that the regularity of factory work combined with the ownership of clocks and watches and combined with the adoption of mean times and the introduction of standard times would have sort of further enhanced time sense, time discipline, time orientation, as Thompson calls it, that seemed suddenly sort of less, sure than I had expected. And then you could sort of think based on what historians in sort of Thompson's vein had written about this. So basically, when I looked at debates about especially the introduction of summer time, so daylight saving time, which kind of followed debates about mean times in Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century. When I looked at these daylight saving debates, I found that people actually had tremendous difficulties in understanding, if you want, what we would refer to as kind of abstract clock time. They still very much thought of time as determined by natural rhythms, very much determined by daylight and darkness, by the setting of the sun, the rising of the sun, the seasons, and so on. And it was no sort of contradiction for them to basically inhabit both the time of these natural rhythms, but also to own a watch, possibly, or to, adjust their watch by looking at the village clock on like pinned to the church clock tower or something like that. This was not a contradiction, but still, they struggled to understand this new time, and it seemed to me that based on these findings and based on these difficulties, that sort of the notion that time discipline and a time sense and time orientation had become very widespread with factory work alone was difficult to uphold based on what I was reading. And this also seemed to explain why sort of capitalism in the sense that Thompson and others had pinpointed it may not have been as instrumental for this process than previously thought. And it seemed to explain why, typical kind of capitalist interests were relatively absent from, these movements to standardize time and to introduce mean times. So I've been talking about this for quite a while. Do you want me to talk about religion and colonialism and empire, or
if you can talk, a little bit about religion and colonialism. You know, part of the capitalism colonialism, I guess, matrix, if you want to call it that, it's fascinating in different parts of the book, just talking about, for example, railway and communications infrastructure as depending, like their integration depending heavily on these standards of time that are then also irrelevant or actively opposed by people in different places. And so I wonder if you can pull out some of those dynamics. I was asking about religion also, in part because I think what you try to do or what you do very well in the book is, you know, there's a lot of resistance to these different sort of time regimes that are being proposed, or there's a lot of debate, maybe even more than resistance. But then there are parallel conversations that aren't necessarily about Europe and Europe's propositions of time. But for example, there's one example where you talk about the telegraph in Beirut kind of transforming how legal precedents over timekeeping in Islam are determined. So maybe you can talk a little bit about those two, whether or not they're connected. That's fine.
Yeah, sure. So these new infrastructure projects, such as railways, such as telegraphy, steamships, and so on, obviously from a certain point on sort of benefited from the application of more accurate and sort of more easily calculable mean times. So that's undeniable. And there were certainly, especially in the United States, this is sort of a little bit of a kind of a particularly American story, especially in the United States, there were railway interests heavily invested in the process of applying standard time and introducing uniform mean times. This was also the case in Europe and in the colonial world, but much less forcefully so. And the reason was that sort of European railways, like in perhaps some contrast to the American story, were often, if you want, kind of government-sponsored or even from a certain point on nationalized government projects, which served certainly, you know, to a secondary degree, capitalist interest, but which in the first instance actually very much had a kind of nation-building, state-building, integrational purpose, and did, especially in Germany, a lot to kind of unify territory. In France, it's sort of a very similar story. So the role and the function of railways, and you can add telegraphy to that, certainly has a connection to, you know, sort of the growing integration of the world economy and world markets and so on. But especially with regard to Europe, it also has this kind of state building, nation building aspect to it very much. So sometimes we have to sort of just distinguish between the American story and the ways in which European governments also simply because they could and because perhaps in certain instances they were more centralized, could use railways in certain ways that other places couldn't. But still, there is obviously a connection between these interests and between the ways in which economic life benefited from the improvement and the introduction of these new technologies. At the same time, these technologies, of course, were instrumental to imperial and colonial endeavors. The building of railways and telegraphy lines, this is sort of well established in literature on history of science and technology and in literature on colonialism and imperialism. These kind of infrastructure projects did a lot to consolidate empire, to make empire and the extension of empire possible over growing distances, and to facilitate and to improve sort of communication between centers and peripheries. But at the same time, what I think my book also tries to show is that this world of, you know, infrastructure and communication was rather fragile and was prone to, if you want, kind of malfunction and really just, you know, the infrastructure put in place not working. Over and over again, you read in the conversation that, you know, comes from different colonies and arrives in Berlin or London, you read about the ways in which telegraphy lines break down and you know, railway schedules aren't working as well as they've been just kind of drawn up. So I think sort of generally there's a tendency to rightly see these infrastructure projects as very powerful and very important to colonial rule, but there was also ways in which they didn't work as well as they were intended to. And it took a long time to perfect them and to really sort of get these systems to work more efficiently. And that was very much the same with regard to time and the application to the application of new mean times. The process of applying and actually, you know, sort of forcefully using new times took much longer and really came to bear on societies around the world much later than you could expect. But, and this gets me to, if you want, resistance or parallel conversations about time that were taking place, which you referred to. But this didn't mean that societies around the world wouldn't have taken sort of a keen interest in time in these very same decades. And it shows you something about the kind of symbolic, cultural, and social meanings and qualities of time that go far beyond both the sort of instrumentalist, capitalist need for integration, and also the sort of nationalist drive to integrate territories. Time always had these very symbolic and profoundly social qualities and meanings associated to it. And this is why, for instance, in British India, even though, you know, practically the application of new mean times and the introduction of new times may have remained rather sort of patchy, Indian nationalists very strongly objected to basically abiding by the time of the colonizer. So when the British administration at two points, first in the 1880s and then again in the early 20th century around 1905, 1906, tried to basically extend the system of mean times and to introduce a standard time, a uniform time for all of India, this sparked protests and sort of became tied up with an early nationalist movement that was coming into existence, especially in the city of Bombay, so that basically protest against the new British time was at the same time a more or less open criticism of British colonial rule over the entire subcontinent, of the arbitrary nature of that rule and the ways in which it interfered with people's daily lives, with people's work rhythms, with people's sometimes religious obligations. These were the kind of objections that these early nationalists voiced against British time as it was supposed to replace local Bombay time. And especially as one, and in fact as one curiosity of this whole story of standardization and the transformation of time, Bombay actually retained its own local time until 1950. So even after Indian independence, there was sort of a brief moment when Bombay, as then the only city in India, would have its own local time, while everybody else now adhered to the standard that is still Greenwich plus 5.5 hours. So this was one example of how loaded and how sort of symbolically, socially charged time was, despite the perhaps rather feeble, if you want, application of some of these meantime projects. And other examples can be found, for instance, in, as you mentioned, a place like Beirut, where we're looking at a society that in the late 19th, early 20th century is still under Ottoman rule, so it's part of the Ottoman Empire. It's part of the Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire in that region. But the Ottoman Empire and the Arab provinces at this point are sort of facing a growing challenge from European imperial interests informally. So you have missionaries, you have consuls, you have obviously merchants, economic interests that sort of increasingly penetrate and set up a palpable presence in these regions and start to kind of crowd out, for instance, local commerce, local economic interests. And this is perceived as a challenge and as a threat amongst elites, some elites in this region who observe this. And of course, at the same time, we're talking about the 1880s, 1890s, for instance, now. At the same time, these elites see that, you know, large parts of the formerly uncolonized worlds, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, is falling under the sway of European imperialism, very rapidly so. So what they come up with in response to this challenge and in response to the possible threat of, you know, becoming colonized is a kind of reform movement, which is referred to as the Nahda in Arabic, and takes on a broad variety of forms. It consists of calls, perhaps most importantly, to improve education throughout the region, to basically sort of create a society of educated, strong, in this case, sort of Ottomans, Arabs, that would be able to withstand the challenge of European empire and European colonialism. And tied to that is what these reformers recommend as a kind of very targeted adoption of certain aspects that have made Europeans in particular successful. So certain aspects of European science, of European ways of life, should be in a very strategic and kind of targeted way adopted by Arabs, Ottomans, in order to kind of self-improve, self-modernize, you could say. And so what I found when I read some of the well-known outlets in which these reformers published at the time was that as one aspect, they very much focused on time management, or what we could call time management today. So they exhorted their fellow citizens in Beirut, in the Levant, to not waste time mindlessly, and they kind of very much pick up on the much older the notion that time is money. This is translated into Arabic and recurs over and over again in some of these reformist tracts and texts. So they basically sort of argue that if individuals would only manage their time more wisely, for instance, by, you know, dividing up their day into different chunks of time and then dedicating these chunks of time to specific useful activities, studying, learning, working, and so on, that would overall basically yield a society, or as they say, a nation, that ultimately would be strong enough, progressive enough, to withstand this challenge of sort of European aspirations, European empire in the region. So this is a call to adopt certain European ways of life and practices. But such calls, and that was among the kind of more interesting things that I found, were always mixed with ways to try and reconcile these European notions and sort of what was perceived as the typical European management of time, to mix that and reconcile that with what you could call sort of more local indigenous notions and concepts of time. So to give you one example, what some of these reformers do is they merge sort of this idea of time management with a much older concept of time as fate, which actually goes back as far as even sort of pre-Islamic poetry, and is later with the arrival of Islam in the region incorporated into Islam. And it basically consists of the idea that time, sort of in this sense of fate, means a lifespan in which certain things happen to you, occur to you. And sort of in the eyes of these reformist thinkers in the late 19th and early 20th century, you can very actively manage not just, you know, time in the kind of European sense, but your fate. So dahar, the term that is used in Arabic to describe this, dahar can be steered, can be actively managed, and sort of to manage your time or fate wisely, at the same time means to manage your life wisely. And we can imagine that through the use of such key terms, such as dahar, which does not have a sort of 100% equivalent in the European discourse about these things, through the use of such key terms, such debates would resonate with local people in kind of different ways than they would have otherwise if such calls for improvement had consisted of a sort of one-to-one emulation of purely sort of European concepts. And then the other instance that you mentioned was for me one of the most fascinating finds, really, that made it into the book, and that, as you said, concerns telegraphy and religious time, and the question of whether it is in accordance with Islamic law to use the telegraph to basically determine the end and beginning of the Islamic month, and the end and beginning of Ramadan, in particular, Ramadan, because, of course, as the fasting month, it has sort of a special standing in the Islamic lunar calendar overall. And it was one of these instances where I happened upon a book by, or this text, which became really the foundation for this chapter, by pure coincidence. I was merely looking for basically a work that I had seen referenced somewhere that would give me an idea of sort of the extent of telegraphy networks in the region in the late 19th, early 20th century. And I knew there was this book, but I couldn't find it anymore. And I was at that point based at the American University of Beirut and was using their library. And they have a very good library catalog in which you can search not just with Latin characters, but Arabic characters, and in Arabic as well as other languages. But I had also noticed that some of the entries that I found when I searched in Arabic, I would not find in using Latin characters. So sometimes there were translation or transliteration problems. So it was always kind of safer to do searches in both. So I couldn't find the telegraphy book by just, like, you know, using French or English and the Latin characters. So I typed in the Arabic word for wire, which is just basically bark, and ended up finding not the book I was actually looking for, but a book that had been written in 1911 by a religious reformer based out of Damascus, Jamal ad-Din al-Qasimi, someone who I then found out was sort of relatively well-known to scholars, especially of religious reform movements in Damascus of this period. And he had written a book about, sort of loosely translating the title, Guiding Mankind in Using the Telegraphy for Determining the Religious Month. And I read this title, and I could not make sense of it immediately. And so when I began to read the book, I noticed, so I found that this was a discussion about combining sort of the stipulations of Islamic law and the Sharia with the use of new technologies, such as the telegraph, especially in religious rituals, and in this case, the ritual of determining the end at the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan. So it is a perfect example for how reformist thinkers of the period, again, try to reconcile sort of traditional notions, and in this case, Islamic law, with innovations and with, in this case, technological innovations such as the telegraph. And what was particularly beneficial about this one book was that at the end of this sometimes very kind of, you know, specific legal elaboration that he gave over almost 100 pages, at the end of this book he had appended 12 fatwas, legal rulings that had been issued by contemporaries of his, roughly speaking, in and around the Mediterranean world, from Algeria to Syria, Beirut, and so on, who had also spoken to this matter. When I saw these 12 fatwas and tracked down, as far as I could, their authors, I realized that this was actually a debate that ranged much further than just this one individual, and that had involved some of the most prominent religious reformist figures of the time period. Just one example of a name that is well known to scholars of Middle East history, Rashid Rida, was perhaps the kind of foremost religious reformer and editor of a very important journal out of Cairo in the period. He was one of the authors who I found in that appendix. And it turned out, as I then found when I kind of browsed through his journal, that he had actually opined on this question several times, even beyond what was in the book. So I ended up writing a chapter on this controversy as it had erupted around 1910-11, around the shores of the Mediterranean. And I found that this was a conversation, as you said, that had little to do with, if you want, European prompts or keywords or, you know, even attempts to introduce and standardize times. This was a discussion that was similarly motivated by an impression of an increasingly connected world, by an impression of, what new means of communication and transportation did and could do and meant. But it was not a discussion that relied heavily or was inspired even by conversations that were happening in Europe. It was a perfect example for, if you want, different societies responding to similar, much broader, overarching economic and social developments, but doing so very much in their own idiom, on their own terms, out of their own concerns. And in this case, the concern was Islamic law and religious timing. And to just briefly explain why this was controversial at all, the Islamic calendar, of course, being a lunar calendar, basically determines the beginning of any new month by citing the new moon. This is what Muhammad has ordered his followers to do in the Quran. So when the new moon is cited, you need a number of witnesses who testify to having seen the new moon. And then at least that was sort of beginning to be the practice in the late 19th, early 20th century. A court, a Sharia court somewhere, will rule whether the sighting and the testimony given about sighting the new moon are valid. And that means, if that is the case, that means the new month has begun. And the beginning and the end of Ramadan are especially important because, of course, Ramadan is a special month, being the fasting month, being holy month, and also containing at the end an important holiday, the Eid, that is still, of course, celebrated today when Ramadan ends in Muslim societies all over the world. So these were special days, and special importance was attributed to Ramadan versus other months. So the question that these legal experts, and they were, you know, mostly sort of religious reformers trained in Islamic law to a certain degree, the question that they raised was, were twofold, basically. The first was about the reliability of new technologies and whether something like the telegraph was trustworthy and reliable enough to transmit a message that would relay that someone in a remote province had sighted the new moon and that basically sort of maybe a local Sharia court had validated that sighting. And so news of this event was now transmitted to the center somewhere, the administrative center in Cairo or wherever it was. And officially, then Ramadan would have been declared to have begun. But the question was, can you do that just based on a telegraph? Is the telegraph trustworthy enough, reliable enough to convey a message of such importance? So you have a long kind of legal discussion about the reliability of the telegraph, and of course, there's a simultaneous attempt to paint the telegraph not as a, if you want, European or Western invention, but rather actually in this case as an Ottoman feature, as an instrument of the Ottoman state that was governed by Ottoman laws, laws that, for instance, laid down specifications as to how someone wanting to send a telegram had to identify themselves, had to provide proof of identification of some sort before they were allowed to send a telegram, and so on. So a whole kind of framework of rules and laws governing telegraphy, which was drawn up by the Ottoman state and which had nothing to do, if you want, with sort of the Western origins of this new technology. So this was one aspect of the debate. And then perhaps even the more interesting aspect of the telegraphy debate pertained to what you could call sort of questions of distance and belonging and how large, how far away Muslims could be to still be part of a supposedly universal Muslim ummah. All Muslims basically living, you know, anywhere in the world. And these were questions that, even though they were not prompted or inspired by simultaneous European discussions, they were very similar to discussions that Europeans were having about standard time in these very same decades. What the legal experts, the problem that legal experts were rising basically was, how far apart can Muslims live to still observe one and the same moon sighting? Of course, as it was well known to Muslim astronomers, sighting the new moon was to a certain degree determined by latitude and longitude. So theoretically, places further apart could be said to have observed, you know, different start and end dates of a month, simply because the observation sighting the new moon would have slightly, or sometimes even more notably, would have differed. So what they basically posed as a problem was how far, as I said, can Muslims live apart and to still be a part of the sort of universal Muslim community? It was really only through telegraphy and through the possibility of transmitting news about moon sighting over a growing distance that such questions even posed themselves. Previously, when telegraphy had not even been available to transmit messages about moon sighting over growing distances, it would have simply stayed a local affair, and there wouldn't have been the issue, if you want, of of distance. But this was one example of how Muslim legal experts basically raised the question: how universal can time be? Can, in this case, religious time and calendar time be? Given that we know that the science behind this is actually sort of very local. So very, very, as I said, similar to debates about universal time, in this case clock time, standard time, and the suppression of local times as it was being discussed by European scientists and diplomats in the same decades, but not connected, as you said, to these debates.
There are a lot of interesting things come up, and one thing that I was quite drawn to, which you kind of you spatter throughout the book and land on a bit before the conclusion, is this notion of time or temporal pluralism and calendar pluralism, and that amidst all of these debates, you do see places where there is a pluralism that emerges or that already exists and is sustained. So I'm wondering if, you know, as we start to come to the conclusion, if you can talk about places where temporal or time pluralism and calendar pluralism thrived, and also just give a little bit of background on what these things even are.
Yeah, absolutely. So as I came to find sort of the coexistence of different ways of understanding both clock time but also calculating calendars, the coexistence of different time regimes was very much the norm pretty much around the world and even in Europe for much longer than you could assume. And people were actually much more comfortable with living with different time regimes, with temporal pluralism, than you could expect judging from the way things mostly are, at least in sort of the Western world today. So what I found was that in certain places, simply because of the coexistence of different, for instance, religious groups, there was sort of an amplified temporal pluralism. And Beirut, or a place like Beirut, was perhaps one of the most pronounced examples of this. But you can imagine other similar sort of types of places in which you would have found the same kind of constellations. Think port cities in general, where you have a lot of inflow of people from different backgrounds with different sort of religious backgrounds. Think generally kind of colonial cities where, again, you have a mix of people, European colonial administrators, traders, local elites, and so on. These types of cities, which were, you know, sort of fairly widespread, I would say probably until, you know, the middle of the 20th century in this sense, these types of cities were a kind of a laboratory almost for a type of temporal pluralism that later got lost. Would be an interesting question to discuss whether actually we are sort of returning again to a more plural time regime now, but at least for a while during sort of the mid-20th century, we can assume that there was less of this pluralism. So in a place like Beirut, what did this look like? In a place like Beirut, you had obviously Muslims who followed their Islamic lunar calendar, which not just uses a different era, starts at a different point in time, but also is a lunar calendar, so is different from sort of the Gregorian calendar in that regard. And newspapers, for instance, would on their header indicate the Islamic date and then mostly the Gregorian date, so the Gregorian calendar date as well. And then because the Levant was and is a region in which there are also many Orthodox Christians, there was the sort of unreformed Eastern calendar and date as well. So often you had actually three dates on the header of the newspaper. And the situation could get even more complicated when you added what is referred to normally as the Ottoman fiscal calendar, which is a purely administrative year that began in March and sort of had to do initially with tax collection and agriculture, but had sort of remained in use for official administrative purposes. So when the Ottomans, the Ottoman administration made an announcement, it would often use that calendar to indicate a date. So there was pluralism in the way of dates and calendars. And in addition to that, you had, of course, sort of, if you want, a pluralism of clock times. For Muslims, the fivefold daily prayer that observant Muslims are supposed to follow is very much determined kind of the division of the day and the announcement of prayer times by the muezzin from the minaret made this sort of very audible, and this was not limited, obviously, to just Muslim constituents, but the call for prayer was heard by others as well. And then, because this was a region in which Christians lived, there were a growing number of missionaries active in the region from different backgrounds who built churches, and the churches had clock towers and bells, so that the announcement of hours and the sounding of church bells sort of added another layer of time. And then to further complicate matters, there were differences in counting time. There was what newspapers and people would refer to as Arab and what they called Frankish, which basically meant European time. So Arab time basically counted the hours of the day beginning from sunset and divided the day into two halves of, or 24 hours into two halves of daylight and nighttime. And because the duration of these two blocks obviously differed with the seasons, the days being longer or shorter in summer and winter respectively, these were unequal hours. And while sort of the sort of unequal nature of these hours had been smoothed out, at least to a certain degree, at this point in the late 19th, early 20th century, through various ways of calculating and techniques, there was still the matter that the day actually began at sunset. So when you found an indication in a newspaper stating Arab time, you had to have in mind that the day began at sunset. On the other hand, of course, through the increased presence of Europeans in the region, the use of European time was becoming more widespread. And for that purpose, newspapers, when they printed, from steamboat schedules to anything really, they would specify whether they were talking about Arabic time or European time in this case. So here you have a situation where just simply the ways of denoting and calculating time, both clock times and calendars, are pretty, variegated. And that was probably an extreme, but as I said, you can imagine similar types of places that existed really up to the middle of the 20th century where the situation would have been comparable. And in addition to that, and this is something I want to kind of highlight in the book, is in addition to that, you have a way in which people, even in Europe, not just in these special places like Beirut, even in Europe, live with sort of multiple time regimes or live with multiple notions of time. And I touch a little bit upon that when I talked about the difficulties of imagining something like daylight saving. So the idea that you just move, basically time back and forward twice a year when you switch to daylight saving time and then off of it again in the fall and so on. When I talked about the difficulties of imagining something like that, what I found in discussions about generally sort of the adoption of mean times and daylight saving time in particular was that, as I said, people were very comfortable inhabiting sort of different simply conceptualizations of time. So time as something that is regular, uniform, determined by the clock, but also time as something that still is quite irregular, determined by the seasons, by the sort of work that, by this, especially sort of kind of agricultural work that certain seasons bring with them, even in an age when industrialization has advanced pretty far, especially in a place like Britain. So people were comfortable inhabiting these different time regimes. What you find is that they were much more consciously doing so, and they were much more apt at moving between different calculations, for instance, of calendars, of converting a lunar calendar date to a Gregorian date. People were much more comfortable sort of moving between these different systems in these particular places, such as Beirut, where temporal pluralism and the coexistence of different times was really so pronounced and so enhanced. Then in Europe, that's what I'm saying, basically.
And with a book like this, I mean, thank you so much again. It's a very fascinating read, and I'm glad that we got through. I mean, there are almost two or three kind of different stories of time that take shape throughout the book. So for anyone who reads it, I encourage you to read all the way until the end, because there is sort of a pivot around the third or fourth chapter that takes place, and you know, all comes back together at the end with this question of was all this integration really integration, or was it fracture? Was it homogeneity, or was it, you know, did it produce more unevenness than homogeneity? Are some of the questions you sort of pose at the end. What are you working on now, if I may ask? And, you know, how do you continue and build on this, or which direction are you moving these days?
Yeah. So one, you know, rather, if you want, more conceptual problem, underlying problem in all these issues that we touch upon in the story of time unification and globalization is the relationship between, if you want, states, nations, and as you say, something like, you know, nationalism on the one hand, or for fragmentation, and on the other hand, integration and flows that cross the borders of nation states and regions and so on, flows of people, goods, ideas, and so on. So the tension between homogenization and fragmentation, as some like to call it, the tension, if we speak, we're speaking sort of in more concrete terms, looking at the second half of the 19th century, the tension between state building and really sort of the rise of nationalism and stronger states in this period, and the increase of flows, connections, what some people like to call globalization, interconnectedness, and so on. It is striking that these two things basically occur at the same time. And as I try to show a little bit sort of in the book, I think this is not by coincidence that this happens at the same time. These processes are sort of mutually reinforcing, influencing one another. And it's not just sort of an odd paradox that is out there, if you want, the simultaneity of nationalism and the integration of the world economy and so on. There's more to that. But it's also a very difficult question to which there's sort of no you know, answer that can be given kind of across time. So this changes when we look into the 20th century, the relationship between, if you want, territory and flows, border, flows, movements, and so on. And basically, what I'm doing in my new project is I'm looking at the same overarching problem, which continues to fascinate me, but in a completely different context, in a completely different setting, and also in a quite different time period. So my new work, which is tentatively called, which I call at the moment, Archipelago Capitalism, is a book project that deals with the emergence of tax havens, of offshore money markets, and special economic zones, free trade zones, sometimes called export processing zones, roughly from the 1920s to the 1980s. And the idea is that this period from the 20s to the 1980s is normally a time in which the state, and the nation state in particular, are thought to have been really important, and that's undeniable. It is the time period when sort of empires gradually decline and ultimately come to an end, are increasingly replaced by nation states. It's also a time when something like the New Deal and World War II and certain reforms kind of following World War II create a welfare state in Europe and the United States to a certain degree, which, you know, puts government and again sort of the state in a very important position. It's also, of course, the period in which development ultimately in the third world, in the developing world, and modernization projects also try to kind of make national societies, create nation states out of the ruins of empire. And while this is all happening, and this is what struck me when I kind of became aware of this, you have a simultaneous emergence of a very different kind of legal and in this case, economic and political order, which consists of these sort of smaller territories that are often at the periphery of bigger, more powerful nation states, which take on certain functions and in which certain laws that govern nation states, bigger territories otherwise, are either suspended or simply sort of don't apply. So we see in the interwar period the emergence of tax havens such as Liechtenstein, Luxembourg, the Channel Islands, and certain parts of Switzerland, kind of for the European continent. And then with the end of the British Empire after 1945, sort of the proliferation of that very same order continues in places such as the Caribbean with the Bahamas, the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, British Virgin Islands, so on, so all the well-known tax havens that are still in existence today. And I'm basically interested in the relationship of, you know, these very big questions such as capitalism, the state, what does it mean that just at the moment when states become more important, strong, really kind of dominant as an organizing principle, you have this other legal, economic, political system that sort of emerges on the margins, and how do these things go together? And it's probably a very rather sort of abstract way of combining the two projects, but I do think of them as actually very related on this conceptual level.
Yeah, and again, I mean, the timing of that kind of project, which I'm guessing you began before the big sort of reporting project on tax havens and the global elite, it's very timely. It's super interesting, the work that you're doing, and I look forward to reading that book.
Sure.
So thank you again, Vanessa, for talking with me today. And again, to all the listeners, it's a good read. Well worth getting through to the end. So, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. It was a pleasure, really.